Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off by giving you my 5 takeaways from week 9. Then we'll hand out some midseason awards. And as always, we'll wrap things up with the mailbag. All your questions answered. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Week 9 is in the books. Hard to believe we're halfway through the season. You know what that means? We've got some midseason awards to hand out. We're going to do that with our special guest in just a little bit. But it's just an entertaining weekend of games. The slate didn't look good going into it, but I do have 5 takeaways from what I thought was a fairly entertaining weekend of games. We did have a few things I think that really kind of bubbled up to the surface over the course of the last few days. And my first takeaway from the weekend is, of course, what everybody's talking about, which was the Lamar Jackson show on Sunday night, what he was able to do against a defense that was playing at a generational level. To me, it's the 210 yards rushing, the final score 37-20, which could have been worse if it weren't for a bad stretch of football at the end of the first half for the Ravens. I think the identity of who the Ravens are, how they've built their team, how they're all in on a young quarterback, there's so much you can take from it. So here's the number one thing I would say. So much of this is simply going to be about whether or not Lamar Jackson can stay healthy. That was a concern on him coming out. I think we all sort of knew that he could play this sort of way if somebody sold out to make it work for him. So much of it now is going to be, can you keep a quarterback healthy running the ball 10 to 15 times a game? Because that's how this offense works. I think conceptually we found out this thing is not a gimmick. This is not a fluke, the way that they've been able to put this together. The scheme that Greg Roman is running is sound, is 100% sound. It works at different levels of football. It works in the NFL too. The reason why it hasn't proven sustainable in the NFL is because your quarterback gets beat up. Even Cam Newton, who's 6'5", 270 pounds, feels like his body's breaking down now. Lamar Jackson is not that size, and so I think part of this is going to be how the Ravens manage Jackson and how Jackson manages himself. He seems to be pretty good at protecting himself. The Ravens, of course, at this point, again, around 14 carries a game. He had 16 carries against the Patriots. But the impact he's making is undeniable. And the numbers aren't even crazy from Sunday night. 16 carries, 61 yards, 2 touchdowns. That's 3.8 yards a carry. 17 of 23, 163 yards a touchdown. That's efficient. Nothing crazy, but he affects every single thing about the way you can play defense in the NFL. He's a big reason why Mark Ingram wound up with 115 yards on 15 carries. He's a big reason why they're able to get a guy like Nick Boyle, who had been a blocking tight end involved in the passing game, because there's just too much to cover. You have to leave something open. So I think the way they've set this up is sound. I think the way they've built it makes sense. And I just think that the long-term sustainability of this is going to boil down to one thing, and that is Lamar Jackson's health. Because I believe in what they're doing. Like, I think what they're doing there are a lot of teams that would be lucky to have the sort of infrastructure that the Ravens have had over the years. They've always known what they've wanted to be. This is a different form of it, of course, but it plays right into that. They are a tough, rugged, downhill running football team. And the way that they've set the offense up dovetails perfectly with that. And Lamar Jackson can be that type of player for them. Again, the question is whether or not he can hold up. Takeaway number 2, and this is going to be sort of a two-pronged thing. The Dolphins beat the Jets 26-18, and it's even worse when you look at the details of that 26-18 loss for the Jets. They went 11 plays, 75 yards at the start of the game to take a 7-0 lead. From there, the Dolphins went on a 26-8 run, okay? Take those 75 yards away from the Jets' offensive total. They're under 250 yards of offense for the rest of the game. Sam Darnold, not good in this game. 27 of 39 for 260, a touchdown, a pick. He had the bad moment in the end zone, sort of his butt fumble moment. And so losing this game for the Jets, I think, raises different questions about where they are going forward. But it certainly seems like, given the climate there, given what happened with Jamal Adams, and we'll get to that, given where Sam Darnold is as a quarterback, if things keep going in this direction, I don't know how you can run it back in 2020 with the exact same setup. Maybe it means Gase is gone. Maybe it means there are some staff changes. Maybe it means there are some roster changes. But I just don't think you can roll this back the same way in 2020. So we'll see what happens. But it hasn't been good. This was supposed to be where their schedule got softer, right? They lose game one of that. Coming out of the Patriots game, they play the Jaguars. That was supposed to be a little bit of a, not a layup, but like an easier, like that. That's where the schedule sort of like the heavy lifting was over. They lose the Jaguars. They lose the Dolphins. They're now 0-2 in this part of their schedule. They have the Giants this week. Again, you know, I think a lot of people looked at where the Jets were going into this part of the schedule and thinking to themselves, okay, well, there are a bunch of cupcakes there. Maybe what we're finding out is the Jets are actually the cupcake. And then on the other side of this, before we move on to the next takeaway, I'm impressed with what Brian Flores has done. Tough, tough situation. He's demanded a lot of those players. And it's even harder to demand that much of the players when you're not giving them tangible results. When they're watching some of the best players on the team, your Laremy Tunsils, your Minkah Fitzpatricks walk out the door, it's really hard to sell what Brian Flores is selling them when you're not giving them back tangible on-field results. The fact that they've kept playing hard, I think, has been telling about how he's getting them to buy in. And now I think we see where they're at. And part of it is Brian Flores and Chris Greer focusing in on bringing in a certain type of guy that can handle everything that's going on there. So really good sign they win this game, but even a better sign how hard they've played over the last few weeks. Takeaway number three, there is one undefeated team left. And I don't know that anybody would have answered on November 4th. If I told you on November 4th, before the season started, there will be one undefeated team. Who will that team be? I don't think anyone would have answered that it would be the 49ers. But here we are. And here's the scary thing about the 49ers. Okay, we know what their defense can be. Losing Quan Alexander's tough, but we know what their defense can be. We know how the strength in the lines of scrimmage has been built up there. What's really scary about the Niners is I think they're starting to get Jimmy Garoppolo back. He's coming off the ACL. I think Kyle Shanahan, to his credit, did what he had to do to try and get him in a position where he was comfortable and confident going into the back half of the season. So they didn't ask the world of him early on. And it got even more difficult when they lost their tackles, when McGlinchey and Staley went down. And so basically what Kyle Shanahan did, and this is a credit to him as a head coach, and the credit's warranted here, we've all looked at, you know, Kyle is this brilliant offensive mind, but this is an example of being a head coach. Instead of trying to coach his way out of the offensive issue, instead of trying to come up with answers where maybe there weren't any, Kyle leaned back on the strength of his team, which is the defense. Didn't scrap the plan to make Jimmy Garoppolo more comfortable and give him time to get comfortable on the reconstructed knee. And they kept winning because the defense has been that good. And now it looks like Jimmy Garoppolo is turning a corner and maybe is going to look a little bit more like the Jimmy Garoppolo we saw at the end of 2017. They add Emmanuel Sanders to the mix. And oh, by the way, they're going to be getting those tackles back. Staley and McGlinchey are coming back. And so that's the scary thing about the Niners, is all the things that have got them to 8-0 are there. And I think you get a better quarterback in the second half of the year, you get a better receiver group, and you're certainly going to improve your situation in offensive tackle. So losing Quan Alexander is tough, but the defense may not need to be otherworldly anymore because I think the offense is coming. And they've got, again, one of the best offensive minds in football pushing all the buttons there. Takeaway number four, Josh Gordon going to the Seahawks. I love this for a very specific reason, because Russell Wilson has shown he can make it work. Because Russell Wilson has turned into, I think, what Tom Brady was 10, 12 years ago. Here's what I mean by that. And we're going to talk more about this in a minute. Early in Brady's career, he was seen as a game manager. He wasn't throwing for 300 yards a game. He had a great defense. He had a great defensive coach as his head coach. He had a running game. They didn't need him to be Superman to win games. And he proved to be clutch. He proved to have more talent than people thought he did when he was drafted in the sixth round in 2000. And he grew through that. And eventually, it went from Brady the game manager to Brady the guy who's capable of carrying a team, to Brady who's capable of carrying people around him who may need it a little bit, to Brady who's going to lift everybody up. And I think that's what Russell Wilson's become. Look who he was throwing to down the stretch on Sunday. DK Metcalf wasn't on the team last year. Jacob Hollister wasn't on the team last year. So what I like about Josh Gordon going there, Russell Wilson has shown he can make it work with different types of guys. Give him another weapon. Trust him that he's going to be able to make it work with someone new. Makes all the sense in the world. Seahawks are a really interesting team going into the second half of the year. And finally, takeaway number five, my final takeaway from the trade deadline. This new world is going to be interesting. And Jamal Adams, to me, the Jets safety, gave us a window into why over the course of the last 7 days. We all love that the trade deadline means something now, right? We all love the fact that we're not sitting there with, I mean, making up fake. Like a few years ago, a lot of the major websites would come up with like these fake trades because there was a void there. And everybody's like, what would the trade deadline be if it was real? And now it is. And even though we didn't have the deadline day deals that I think we all sort of expected, we got names traded in the first 6 or 7 weeks of the season before the deadline. Jalen Ramsey, Laremy Tunsil, Emmanuel Sanders, Mohamed Sanu. So here's the flip side of that. To get guys like that traded, for that sort of action to happen, there's got to be discussions on more than just those players. GMs have to be more open to talking about different guys in their roster, because that's how that happens, is those discussions start because somebody picked up the phone and called somebody and maybe discussed a player that the other guy on the other end of the line wasn't expecting to discuss. And so that's how this whole thing happens, right? So now far higher percentage of players in the NFL are having their names thrown around in trade talks than would have been the case maybe 5 or 6 years ago. The downside of that is that stuff gets out. And when that stuff gets out, players get pissed. And so that's what we saw with Jamal Adams. The Jets didn't put Jamal Adams on the trade block. The Jets accepted a couple phone calls on him. The Cowboys, I can tell you, saw some of the Jamal Adams stuff in the media 3 or 4 weeks ago, and that's what prompted them to call the Jets. And that's what sort of got the market going on Jamal Adams. Would they have moved Jamal Adams? Yes, he has a price. I think the two guys in the Jets roster that probably would be off limits would be Sam Darnold and Quinnen Williams. Everyone else is fair game. So there was a price for him. But it was a very, very high price. It was a 1 and 2 twos, and all the Cowboys were offering was a 1 and a backup player. And so these things never got that serious. But just having his name involved in those talks, like Jamal Adams was pissed about it. And I don't know that he's not, you know, partially culpable here either. But this is sort of the fallout from where the climate in the NFL and the trade market is going, is you are going to have players whose names are going to get out there and they're not going to be happy that they were talked about in this way. So, and if you want to know why nothing happened just on Tuesday, a week ago, I think I mentioned this in the podcast last week real quick. Number one, I think certain GMs saw the interest in their players come back and say to themselves, well, wait a second, this smart team, they're all interested in my guy. I don't know if I want to move him. So there was that. And I also think because of what Tunsil went for, because of what Ramsey went for, because of what Sanu and Sanders went for, the prices were higher than they have been, to the point where the buyers were not completely comfortable with what they would be paying for the players who are out there. But my main takeaway is the climate's changed, and I do think that that's going to create a different dynamic in the player-team relationship. And we will get to our special guest right after this. All right, so We're going to go back to our roots one more time here as we hand out some mid-season awards and bring in one of the pioneers of this podcast from WPRO in Providence, my personal buddy from our days at 98.5 The Sports Hub, Andy Gresh. Gresh, what's happening?
Bird, you're very kind. Thank you very much for that warm and welcoming introduction. And now let's rip football players like we always do.
All right. Well, so here's how it's going to work. We have picked out the six major awards. Those awards: MVP, Offensive Player of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year, Offensive Rookie of the Year, Defensive Rookie of the Year, and Coach of the Year. We are going to give you our picks for each of those awards, battle it out over each of those, and then we'll get you out of here, Gresh. And I'm going to start off the field with the Coach of the Year. And this is actually one, to me, there's like a bunch of good candidates here. Yeah, I very well could have given this to Kyle Shanahan. I think John Harbaugh's come on. Bill Belichick could win it in almost any year. But I'm going Kyle Shanahan here. I think what he's done with the Niners, beyond just the fact that they're 8-0, has been outstanding. And I'm talking about the fact that he's got a quarterback coming off a torn ACL. I'm talking about the fact that they've managed to fight through without both their starting tackles over the course of the last month or so. Just time and time again, and I talked about it off the top, he has grown into a real head coach. And I think what's most impressive about it is the way he's been able to sort of subjugate his ego, where I think a lot of guys who have that sort of tag as being the offensive guru, in the face of the injuries that they've had on the offensive side of the ball, in the face of having, you know, a quarterback coming off an ACL injury, would have tried to like sort of guru their way out of it. And he never tried to do that. He basically closed ranks on offense and said, we're going to win on defense. And so Kyle Shanahan, my midseason 2019 Coach of the Year.
That's a great pick, Bert, and very hard to argue with considering they're the last remaining undefeated team in the NFL. I'm going to give my nod to Frank Reich of the Indianapolis Ooh. Colts, because I don't know how many head coaches would have been able to pivot with the decision that was thrown his way by his starting quarterback, Andrew Luck, and have to keep that football team focused, get them winning and believing in another quarterback, and to be able to make the adjustments that they've had to deal with in terms of tweaks, to be able to make the quarterback more comfortable. They have to play with Brian Hoyer the other day. You know, look, I mean, the holder didn't do a great job of setting Vinatieri up to be able to hit the game-winning kick. To me, they should really only have two losses. They played everyone tough this year. They've been good on the road and at home. And I just can't envision how tough it would be, Bert, for other coaches to be able to lose their quarterback in the manner and fashion that they did and be able to regroup and not have that team go into the tank. Been thoroughly impressed with what Frank Reich has done in Indianapolis.
Great pick. And here's the one that was toughest for me to not select for this. Sean Payton in New Orleans. I think what Sean has done there has been maybe as good a coaching job as he's done in his 14 years in charge there, and that's really saying something. To be able to manage losing your starting quarterback that way and to get creative and to do it different ways. Now, one of the reasons why I chose Kyle over him is I thought it was so close, and I went with the undefeated guy, and I really think the Saints, a big part of their success has been the way they built the roster up around Drew Brees, which Sean Payton has a hand in as well. But to be able to creatively find ways to move the ball on offense, to get Teddy Bridgewater ready to play, to find a way to use Taysom Hill, to win without Alvin Kamara over the last few weeks, and to develop all the young players they have over the last 3 or 4 years, I think Sean Payton should be right there in the race.
I'm with you, Bert, and I think that the commonality of all these coaches that we reference is that they've proven to be adaptable within their scheme and have adaptable coaching styles. Because let's face it, and I'm assuming, you know, this happens probably more in college than it does at the pro level, but it does happen at the pro level where coaches are just so rigid. You know, by God, this is what I do, and I've done this forever, and we're not going to make changes to scheme, or we're not going to invest in a guy who is unconventional, kind of like what the Ravens have done
Yep.
with Lamar Jackson. Every one of these coaches that we reference have had to go outside of themselves to be able to coach to the talent of their football team so that they can win and win at a high level. And there are just so many stubborn cusses out there. All these guys that we've talked about have done a great job of working with the talent that they've got and finding different ways to be able to win. And we make it sound like it should happen more and that it's so simple. But as the NFL proves year in and year out, it isn't necessarily always that way.
No, I mean, I think you see that in New England with the way they're able to change who they are week to week. Like, it looks easy, and it's like, well, that makes sense. Why wouldn't everybody do that? Everybody doesn't do that because it's really hard to do. Okay, so we're going to go from, I think, what might have been one of the toughest calls on the board. To me, this is the easiest call on the board. Defensive Rookie of the Year, I think it's Nick Bosa. I think Nick Bosa's like should be in contention for Defensive Player of the Year. And it's not just the seven sacks, Gresh. It's the way he seems to affect things on every single play. It's the way he's making D Ford a better player, even though D Ford's only playing about 40% of the snaps because he's got a bulky knee. It's what he's meant for DeForest Buckner on that D-line. And it's how that D-line collectively now has been able to sort of mask some of the issues they've been working through in the secondary. That Niners defense has been really, really good pretty much through the entire year. And I think Nick Bosa is as big a piece to that as anyone. I think not only is he Defensive Rookie of the Year, I could see him going on a run here over the next few years, like J.J. Watt did early in his career, where he's in contention for Defensive Player of the Year every single year.
You know, I hate to agree with you, but I agree with you. I mean, it's not that there aren't other choices, as you mentioned.
I mean, Josh Allen from Jacksonville would be the one that would be even in the neighborhood, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, Bosa's gotten off to such a good start. And, you know, unlike his brother, there's really, you know, there hasn't been the big injury that has set him back. And I also think, too, that, you know, playing on a good football team, man, that really helps you as a rookie because – you've got the ability to make what I guess I would call quiet mistakes. You know, I'm sure he hasn't been perfect. Like, we look at all these numbers and see that the sack numbers are gaudy, and we see all these great things that he's been able to do. And a lot of that is because he has played around good football players and on a football team that's been winning. So I'm with you right now. It's a little limited in terms of candidates for the old Defensive Rookie of the Year. But that said, Bosa's had the impact I think that the 49ers thought he was going to have.
No question. And it's, I mean, two plays really, I think, typify who he's been, right? And one was against the Rams where he took Andrew Whitworth, who's about 330 pounds, and like a Pro Bowl level left tackle, one of the better players in the league over the course of the last 5 years or so, and bull rushed him right into Jared Goff. So you saw that element of his game. And then there was another play, and it was against Carolina, I believe, where he gets in the backfield, he stops. Kyle Allen tries to pop the ball over his head. He reaches up, he picks it off, and he almost runs it back for a touchdown. And so I think, like, looking at those two plays, you see the juxtaposition of athleticism and just raw brute force. And it's just a rare combination that he has that I think have allowed him to bring all this together. And he's a technician, too. I think, you know, being a former offensive lineman, Gresh, I'm sure you can appreciate it. But, you know, he's one of these guys who, with his hands, I mean, it looks like martial arts. You know, like the way he's able to use his hands to kind of help him get to the quarterback.
And that's really where the defensive line training is going nowadays, is make sure your hands are active. I know for offensive linemen, a lot of it is footwork. You're trying to win that hand battle to get your, you know, the whole low man wins. Well, the inside man wins when it comes to hand placement. And look, their family understands how to play the game. We know that John Bosa, the dad, played in the league. So there's a lot of good bloodlines, a lot of good history there. And I think because of some of that martial arts training, we're seeing guys like Bosa who have the ability to work with their hands but not lose speed in doing so. It becomes a natural part of their movements, where I think at times some of these guys are like, okay, I'm going to set this guy up with this hand motion or this guy up with this footwork. Whereas with him, it seems very, very natural. And there isn't him having to think about how he's going to set up an offensive lineman or what he wants to do. And that's a big – but look, they tell you all the time as a pass rusher, you better have a game plan. Just like they tell offensive linemen, you better have a game plan and understanding sort of what these guys are going to do in the moment. So that, to me, that's what makes him difficult to stop. He's just really, really fluid in pretty much everything he's done out there this year.
Yeah, and you know who deserves some credit there too is his D-line coach at Ohio State, Larry Johnson. If you look at the players who played for Larry at Penn State and then more recently the players who've played for him at Ohio State, they're all like that with their hands. Chase Young, who's coming out next year, is like that. Joey Bosa is like that. Yeah, it's just sort of a really interesting aspect to what all the guys who've played for that guy wind up doing. It's Larry Johnson's dad, the old Chiefs running back.
It all comes back to Ohio State, doesn't it? It's unbelievable. I mean, you're getting craftier. Like, you can tell
you like
you're
it?
So much more experienced at this because you seamlessly wove in an Ohio State suck-up reference in the midst of our conversation.
There could be some recruit. There could be some recruit listening, so I don't want to cheat that recruiter that information.
Who's that big-ass defensive end they got right now?
Chase Young.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, basically you're saying to him, I'm Albert Breer, and I'm gonna hopefully talk about this, and, well, there'll be someone bigger than you to come in and replace you at some point in time.
Okay, shifting gears now. And there is an Ohio State player in the mix here. I'm not going to lie about that, but offensive rookie of the year, I'm not going to give it to him. Terry McLaurin's been good in Washington. I mean, Kyler Murray has – you've seen flashes of who he can be. Daniel Jones with the Giants has had his ups and downs. My offensive rookie of the year, Gresh, is Josh Jacobs, the Raiders running back, who I think is like in the rare position where he's the focal point of an offense for a playoff-level team. And I say that based on where the Raiders have been and how they've played over the first half of the season. I think that they've got a chance to compete for a wild card spot over the back half of the season. And a huge part of it is Josh Jacobs. And I don't think it's all that common that you see a guy making this sort of impact. Zeke Elliott, Saquon Barkley, Todd Gurley when he was a rookie. Like you see, it's not common where an entire offense is built around a guy, but who's a rookie, but that's what we're seeing in Oakland right now. Josh Jacobs has 740 yards rushing, averaging 4.9 yards a carry, 6 touchdowns, and 11 catches for 102 yards. Gresh, I mean, I think back to the days of John Gruden in Oakland, all those years ago with Charlie Gardner and Napoleon Kaufman, and it feels like this is sort of what that is, you know, like where you've got Josh Jacobs as the focal point of the offense. And I think I had that wrong. Was it Napoleon Kaufman? I think Tyron Wheatley, right? No, Tyron Wheatley and Charlie Gardner were the two.
One of those two.
Whatever it was. But Josh Jacobs feels like he's like sort of becoming that guy for John Gruden. And he's been fantastic. I think what we're seeing now, because he was part of a platoon at Alabama, we didn't see the full scope of what he could be. And now I think we're getting to see that.
Boy. You know, this one's tough for me because there is an offensive lineman that you could throw in there.
Give it to me then.
Saints center Eric McCoy. But
all right. I could go with Eric McCoy.
I'm not going with him, though, Bert. I'm going to go with DK Metcalf for the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, all right.
And look, I thought this guy was all show.
Yeah.
He looked
good. I thought he was all hat and no cattle.
Yeah. Oh, great line. I like that. But when you look at him, he looks like everything. You know what he looks like? He looks like a WWE champion is what he looks like. He looks like a superstar in his underwear. And I thought, okay, this guy runs 7, 8, and 9 routes. This isn't anybody who's going to go over the middle. They're going to be able to take him out of games. And you know what? DK Metcalf has shut me up. He's not limited to just the fade routes or the go routes. When you get him mismatched at 6'3", 6'4", against a smaller corner, I mean, he's got the ability to kind of chew people up. You combine that with the fact that his quarterback is playing lights out right now in Russell Wilson. You know, some would say, well, he's, you know, Russell Wilson can play that way because of DK Metcalf. Not a lot of, I mean, there are young wide receivers who come in the league. You mentioned Terry McLaurin. He's one of those who's come in and done well. But normally it's about the quarterback being able to trust those young guys. See New England, mention Tom Brady. And Wilson has been able to trust Metcalf pretty quickly. So I'm going to go with old DK. And you and I think, did a good job of kind of staying away from Kyler Murray. Because I don't know, Bert, if there's any way Kyler Murray could have lived up to the preseason hype as to how good he was supposed to be. And that's to take nothing away from the season he's had so far.
I think he's been fine. You know, like for a rookie, I think he's been fine. Like it's just when we're talking about the best rookie in 2019, I'm with you on Metcalf. I thought it really stuck out to me how much Russell trusted him down the stretch against Tampa on Sunday too. Like how he was willing to go to him on big spots. He had the back shoulder fit. He had the back shoulder throw to him late in the game. And as you know, like that's predicated on trust. Like So, I really think like you see a lot of good signs from DK Metcalf. I was wrong about him as well. Okay, defensive player of the year, and I struggle a little bit with this one, Gresh, because you know. Obviously, with offensive players, I think a lot of times we tie whether we're going to give the award to them to team success. And so, you know, there was a point where it's like, all right, do I give this to a Patriot or a Niner because they've been the two best defenses, right? And there's a big part of me that wanted to give this to Jamie Collins. But I think so much of the Patriots' success on defense has been based on how they come at you with numbers and with depth, right? Like that there are really good players all over the place. And so you could give it to Jamie Collins, Kyle Van Noy, Stephon Gilmore. It's just – so like there was that part of it. And the flip side, I think what I'm going to do here is I'm going to give it to a player, and again, I've got my misgivings about this, who isn't in a very good situation, but has been absolutely dominant, and that's Myles Garrett. He's got 10 sacks. He looks borderline unblockable out there. If the Browns are going to make a run and dig themselves out of this hole they've dug for themselves, then Myles Garrett's going to have to be central to it. To have 10 sacks, be on pace to get to 20, is something else, you know, in your third year. He's living up to all the expectations. He is the guy who offensive coordinators have to stay up worrying about on Saturday nights. And so my defensive player of the year, just because he's been so outstanding individually, is Myles Garrett.
Yeah, I'm going to cave in and go with a New England Patriot, but I'm not going Jamie Collins. I'm going Stephon Gilmore. And Bert, you and I have covered the Patriots for, you know, almost 20 years now. And, you know, we think back to what it was like when Ty Law was here. We think about what it was like when Asante Samuel was here. And I know that when Bill Belichick signed Stephon Gilmore, it was what the hell does he see out of him? Well, the guy's only been targeted 55 times. And I'm not saying that it's the whole, you know, Deion Sanders effect where you have that guy to one side of the field and no one's going to test him and throw over there. But it's pretty damn close, and considering the way we've changed in the NFL really in the last 3-4 seasons to where everybody wants to spread you out and throw the ball, that the fact that teams are consciously staying away from Stephon Gilmore is maybe the best compliment that can be that you can pay to the guy. Look, pass rushers almost always win this award unless there's a corner who has a bunch of interceptions. Hell, you could look at Devin McCourty on his defense, who's got all those turnovers and interceptions. Yep. But to me, the reason the Patriots can do in part what they can do is because whatever role they ask Stephon Gilmore to play, whether it's zone, taking someone out of a game, maybe there's zone concepts and it's almost like a box and one for a, you know, yep, an easy defensive reference to where Gilmore's just running around and playing man on somebody, it gives the Patriots great flexibility. So I'm going to lean Gilmore here. And if there is an honorable mention I'd like to slide in, and I know you mentioned the Saints a little bit earlier, Cameron Jordan's having a hell of a year inside that Saints defense and deserves to be mentioned. Because Aaron Donald, in a way, Bert, is the Bill Belichick of this award. You can almost always put him in there because the guy's just so good and so dominant. Yep. So at least we went outside the box a little
bit. I like the Cam Jordan pick because I think people have overlooked because of what they've been able to do on offense without Drew Brees. Like how the defense is winning games for them. You know, like the defense, like this is legitimately the first time in Drew Brees' career where he's had a defense. Now, they had that defense in 09 that kept turning the ball over and everything else that was great, you know, but that defense would still get gashed. This is the first time I think he's had a defense that can win on its own. And we saw that in the Cowboy game. I think we saw that when they played the Jaguars. We've seen where the defense has completely taken over games where they haven't even needed to ask that much of the offense, which is, I think, going to be fascinating to watch as Drew Brees gets more comfortable coming back off of the injury. All right. Offensive player of the year. couple good candidates here. And this is always a weird one, right, Gresh? Because it's like you always feel like, well, is it how do you separate offensive player of the year and MVP? And really, I try to go away from quarterback. I think the way you want to look at it, most valuable player is about value to a team. Offensive player of the year is about outstanding individual performance, right? Like who is the best at their position and who is better at their position than anyone else is at theirs. And so this was, to me, came down to two guys. Michael Thomas is my honorable mention. On pace for 146 catches, 1,750 yards. That, to me, is outstanding when you consider the quarterback turnover, right? That he had to go through losing Drew Brees and adjust to playing with Teddy Bridgewater to have those sorts of numbers through eight games, 73 catches, 875 yards, and four touchdowns. Really, really good. But the guy I felt like I had to give it to was Christian McCaffrey in Carolina, who – I don't know. I want to run this comparison by you, Gresh. See what you think. Marshall Faulk.
I think it's a very apt reference. That's a good reference because he can do a little bit of everything. You can line him up out wide. Oh my God. I mean, we forget how good Marshall Faulk really was
right
in the heyday and how unique he was for 1997 professional football.
I mean, like, it was like maybe, and I think like you had that to some degree before that with Thurman Thomas. Like, he was that sort of player. Faulk to me was like sort of the first one where he legitimately could have been like a starting slot receiver, right?
Yep.
Like you legitimately could play him as like for a full game as a slot receiver in the NFL. And that's what I think Christian McCaffrey is. 881 yards rushing, 5.3 yards per carry, which is outstanding. 363 yards on 42 catches. I mean, the definition of an all-purpose back. He's not quite as big as a Zeke Elliott or Saquon Barkley, but, I mean, more and more, it feels to me like he's bringing everything to the table. Those guys are. The question, of course, would be durability, but this guy never comes out of the game. And so I just think based on, you know, based on the individual performance he's had, he's another one of these guys who was – part of a team that went through a quarterback change and going from Cam Newton to Kyle Allen, my pick is Christian McCaffrey.
You know, I'm going to go a little wayward on this one relative to what you said and the whole quarterback discussion, because to me, my offensive player of the year is Lamar Jackson. Look,
I
were to rank my top three MVP candidates, Jackson would be just outside of the group of three that I would have for MVP. And, you know, the offense is tailored to him in a way to where he's going to get really good numbers if he goes out and executes. And it's more than just him dropping back, reading a defense, and throwing the ball. And let me be interest a full disclosure. I'm not a huge Lamar Jackson guy. I don't think you can win long-term with Lamar Jackson. Baltimore's got about a 4 to 5 year window before it ends up closing or injuries set in. And there's all the pitfalls that you can have with a move quarterback the way Jackson is. But in terms of just putting on an offensive show, if they threw it to him, he'd be great with the ball after the catch. You can put him in situations to run, whether it's in or out of the pocket, and he does a really good job of being athletic. And of course, I don't think he's a great thrower of the ball, but when you look at what they do for him within that offense, and it was on display against the Patriots, a lot of easy stuff, flat routes to the tight ends. It's, you know, play action, 1-2, ball's either going here, there, or you're running or throwing it away. They've made it easy for him. But in terms of just being able to be the most dynamic offensive player on the field at any time, to me, that's Lamar Jackson. And that's why I go with him for Offensive Player of the Year, because I do think he has earned an award. I just don't think it's MVP.
Okay, so I would tell you that, like, the way I look at it with him, I think, like, what they do is sound, right? Like, I don't think it's gimmicky. Like, I think it's just, I think it's, like, schematically, like, that's sustainable. You can play that way. It works in college football. It works in high school football. It's sustainable schematically. My question is the same as the one you alluded to, which is, can he hold up physically? Can you carry the ball 10 to 15 times from a game from the quarterback position and still be upright at the end of the year. And, you know, someone brought this up to me last week when I was doing sort of a scouting Lamar Jackson piece and an evaluator with another team. He said, look at Cam Newton, 6'5", 270 pounds, and he's breaking down physically. So how do you expect somebody of Lamar Jackson's size to last? And so I think if they can find a way to manage his health, I think this is sustainable. But that's, I mean, it all comes down to that, whether or not he can remain healthy.
Yeah, and I don't know if over the course of years and years that they're really going to be able to expand their base of plays. I think right now what you have are defensive minds that are accruing tape, and they're looking at maybe what Greg Roman did in San Francisco, and then you're looking at how maybe they've tailored it to Lamar Jackson. But I think whereas a New Orleans or a New England offense, they can find a way to reinvent themselves. There is no reinventing with the Ravens offense. And if Lamar Jackson goes down, they're screwed because they don't have the ability to adapt. And to me, Bert, those are two things, and we mentioned it earlier in the Coach of the Year discussion, is there adaptability within that offense? And can Jackson develop more as a passer where it's, we're going to put three or four wide receivers on the field, and we're going to have to run some two-minute drill with him. I don't know if he's ever going to get there. So that's part of the reason why I'm down on him. And look, interest of full disclosure, Lamar Jackson is different than some of these guys that I mentioned. But in terms of the concepts offensively and not being able to expand them, to me, this isn't very different than Tim Tebow or Robert Griffin III. You have to do things a certain way for this guy. And if you don't do it that way, he can't function and be successful.
I think I think he has gotten better as a passer. The one question with him continues to be making anticipatory throws, being able to throw people open. And then, of course, I think the other issue with that offense is like what happens when you get behind, which I think was why it was so key the other night that they got up on New England early.
I agree with you. And another thing, too, is I think teams are going to start to be a little more physical with the receivers and tight ends at the line of scrimmage, if for anything, just to try to throw the timing off. Because to me, when Lamar Jackson is throwing at his best, it's very timing-based. Whereas if you stand him in the pocket and ask him to move his feet a little bit, he's going to get itchy to run. Whereas guys like Brady and Breeze and Rodgers, they can sit back there that extra second in the pocket, survey, and they know where they're going to go. I think if you find different ways to throw the timing off from those tight ends and receivers in the offense, it may just end up slowing down Lamar Jackson enough that it gives you a chance possession to possession to ultimately derail them or put them in positions to where it's field goals, not touchdowns.
Okay, let's go to the big one. Most valuable player. I considered Lamar for this. I considered Deshaun Watson for this. I considered Christian McCaffrey for this. But I'll tell you, Gresh, I went with Russell Wilson, and in the end, when I really thought about it, it wasn't as hard to separate him from everybody else as I thought it would be when I first started to kind of consider the resumes of each. And here's the reason why. I think his career arc's like Tom Brady's. And if you follow me here, and I said this earlier in the podcast, thank you to everybody who's still listening. To me, watching what happened with Brady early in his career, he went from great team around him, great coaching staff, great system, game manager. That's what everybody thought he was in 01, in 02, and 03. And he used a great situation that he was in to grow. And eventually, he became the type of player who lifts everybody up around him. We saw it in 2006 when he was playing with Rashay Caldwell and Jabbar Gaffney and what was left of Troy Brown at the time, right? Like, he got that team to a conference championship game. The year after that, he got Randy Moss in a position for a career renaissance where he broke every NFL record in the book. Brady wasn't Tom Brady as we know him, as we've known him early in his career. He grew into that. Russell Wilson, same thing. Great situation when he came into the league. He didn't have to win games for Seattle. He had Marshawn Lynch. He had a great defense. All they asked him to do was be clutch, and he was that. He won a championship. And now what's happened? Because he's in a great situation, he's been able to use that great situation to evolve as a quarterback. And who is he now? He's somebody who can lift everybody up around him. And I think we saw it on Sunday. The two guys that he was throwing to at the end of that game, Gresh, weren't on the team last year. You mentioned one, DK Metcalf, the other, Jacob Hollister, who they traded for 2 days after the draft, an afterthought at tight end, a guy who's only playing in that spot because their starting tight end, Will Dissly, got hurt. So, to me, Russell Wilson's the MVP, and I think if anybody's going to catch up to him, they've got a lot of ground to cover right now, because I think not only is he playing very well individually, he is lifting up the people around him, and he's a major reason why the Seattle Seahawks are 7-2.
Yeah, I rarely say this. I agree with everything you just said, and I didn't think Russell Wilson had this in him to where he is developed into a great thrower of the football. And there's the ability to spin it, but there's the ability to pass it. And there's a big difference. You know, Drew Brees and Tom Brady, they're great passers of the football, meaning they can put it in spots where their wide receivers, running backs, and tight ends can do something with it. They can protect themselves. And to your point, Bert, he is the high tide for the Seattle Seahawks, is Russell Wilson. I mean, the numbers are just gross. And in an era where completion percentages have gone up, he's at 68.3%, 22 touchdowns, and only one interception. I mean, that's just fantastic numbers, and I don't care who the hell you are. And, oh, by the way, if you sleep on his ability to run the ball, he's only 30 years old. This is a guy who can still run when he needs to. And while the rushing numbers are, you know, they're kind of where you would expect them to be, he's also rushed for 3 touchdowns. He's got 1 fumble that was lost. So 2 turnovers in 9 games, and he's got a combined 25 touchdowns. He's been absolutely amazing. And I'll tell you the other thing too, Bert, and this, I know it's going to get, this part of the conversation may end up getting a little icky for some who are listening, but at one point in time, there was almost a mutiny in that locker room a bunch of years ago because of Russell Wilson, who he was. Maybe people either misinterpreted him or thought he was, you know, whatever those were. He's come through that in flying colors. The organization has supported him. And every year, on the whole, he has gotten better. And you got to give Russell Wilson a ton of credit for, I think it's a pretty good comparison there, Bird, in terms of the career arc. The way this guy's going, if he's throwing 35 touchdowns and under 10 interceptions a year, there's going to be a lot of numbers that are going to put him in a Hall of Fame type discussion when this is all said and done.
And like, to me, it's like, it's finding a way to like push himself into the leadership position too, where, you know, and look, it was what it was 3 or 4 years ago, right?
Right.
Like we know about all of that history. The first thing he said to me when I had him on the phone on Sunday night after they beat the Bucks, I said, like, I brought up the whole Hollister Metcalf dynamic, guys who weren't on the team last year. First thing he brought up was, oh yeah, you know, like we went and we got extra work in LA, and I had all the guys out at the ESPYs, and then we threw after that. And just the awareness of that. You know, like, there are a lot of players who might think, like, hey, you know, that's not really, you know, like, we'll do this, but we're doing it for show. No, it wasn't that. It was, like, he knew he had to invest in his teammates. And he knew, as the quarterback, that was on him. And if he didn't do it, no one else would. And I just think it was so interesting. Like, just that was the first thing he thought of, was what happened on Sunday. The back shoulder throw to Metcalf, the touchdown to Hollister at the end, that's a result of what they were doing in the summer. And I guess the best way to put it, Gresh, it's like everything you want your quarterback to be.
Agreed. And he pulled in Ciara. That is...
No, there's another comp we can make to Brady, right?
Oh, yeah. Who would have thought, right, that 2 good-looking professional quarterbacks would be overachieving when it comes to that level.
Yeah, I know. It's something else. Something in the water in the Big Ten there, Gresh.
Here we go again. It all comes back to the Big Ten. Is it that? Is it that Maurice Claret water or regular?
Different water.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Appreciate.
Sure.
All right. Always appreciate it, Gresh.
Anytime, brother. You know that.
All right, thanks to Gresh. Fantastic, as always, going through the midseason awards. Always a good time, even if it's a little relevant and might make us look stupid in 2 months. It's that time of the week. You guys know how this works. I open up the mailbag. I answer all of your questions. There are two ways that you can get to us each and every week on Tuesday. You can email us at BreerMailbag@gmail.com. That's my last name, B-R-E-E-R, mailbag@gmail.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. We actually prefer you do that because we want to hear your voice on the podcast here. That's 201-596-4346. Now, I'm bringing in my producer, Shelby Royston. Shelby, what we got?
This is from Duncan. How do you see the QB market moving this offseason? A few teams looking like they're positioning themselves to draft high, while the Titans, Bears, and Bucks might be looking for a veteran.
I think it's interesting, Shelby, because I think what you're going to see this offseason is a number of reclamation projects, which is usually the way the veteran market goes, right? And so the names that could be available are guys that are very recognizable and guys that have been in positions as franchise quarterbacks in their current cities. Marcus Mariota, Andy Dalton potentially, Jameis Winston. And then there are two that are super interesting. Cam Newton's one. And I think if I was a betting man, I would bet that Cam Newton probably doesn't play another down this year. And then the other's Tom Brady. And so would the Bears, would the Titans, would the Los Angeles Chargers, if they were to let Philip Rivers hit the market, would those teams be interested in a Cam Newton or a Tom Brady? Do they think they're close enough to a title where they would want to take that sort of risk with a big name player like that? That part of it's fascinating. So I think you're going to have a really, really interesting veteran market. And again, potentially teams like the Bears and Titans out there. We'll see what happens with the Chargers and Rivers. I still think that the Philip Rivers winds up back in the Chargers again. But it's not out of the realm of possibility that you have some musical chairs going on there if the Chargers decide they want to make a run at, say, Brady. And then, you know, Rivers could go to the team that's closest to home, the Titans. There is, like, some potential for some sort of musical chairs there. I'd still say the likelihood is Rivers and Brady stay put. I think Cam's still up in the air. And then Mariota, Dalton, and Winston probably on the move. And I would tell you this. The quarterback class is going to be just interesting because you've got, I think, a handful of players that are sort of in the running to go in the first round. Tua Tagovailoa. Jake Fromm from Georgia, Justin Herbert from Oregon, Joe Burrow from LSU, Jacob Eason from Washington, not in that order, but those five guys I think all have a shot to go in the first round. Jordan Love from Utah State's fallen off a little bit. And then you're going to have teams that are going to be making the decision, do we pick one this year, or do we wait until next year when potentially you're looking at Trevor Lawrence from Clemson and Justin Fields from Ohio State. And so just a fascinating kind of like lots of moving parts offseason coming on the quarterback market. Question number two, Shelby.
From Wes, do you think teams putting an extra emphasis on compensatory picks led to the lack of major moves during the trade deadline? Why would a team ship someone off for a fifth when they think they will get a fourth when they walk in free agency? Could this have inflated the market?
Yes, I would absolutely say so. It set the price for Golden Tate a year ago. The reason the Lions held firm to wanting a third-round pick for Golden Tate, who, again, was over 30 at the time, who was going into a contract year, is they figured there would be a market for him in free agency. And so if they just wrote it out with Tate, they would wind up getting a three back in a comp pick. We'll see if it plays out that way. You know, that comp pick will be awarded in February. And so they held firm to wanting a three. And we saw that with two receivers this year. Now, Emmanuel Sanders, because of his age, won't be able to get the Broncos more than a five, but Emmanuel Sanders goes for a three and a four with a five coming back. And Mohamed Sanu, who has a year and a half left on his deal, goes for a two. And so I certainly think that it's sort of set the floor for certain players because teams are more aware of the comp pick formula. I also think that it's probably hurt players in that, and in a lot of different ways, in that you see like, so for example, Josh Gordon, right? Like, it was possible that a non-contender, and that didn't play out this way, but it was possible that a non-contender could have picked him up. Just knowing that they would have a free comp pick if he played well for them and walked in free agency after the year. There's just, there are a lot of different examples where the comp pick formula has sort of come into play with the way these teams think, and more teams are aware of it. Question number three, Shelby.
We have a voicemail.
Hey, so I know that Robert Saleh's name keeps getting mentioned as a possible head coach candidate, but are teams looking for defensive coaches now? I know all the rage has kind of been offensive young coaches. Would teams go back to a defensive guy for a head coach? Or as a Niners fan, can we have hopes of keeping him next year? Thanks, man. Love the podcast.
Well, thank you for the question. Again, guys, identify yourself so I can give you a shout-out by name here. I would say absolutely that there's going to be a swing back at some point, maybe not this offseason, but a swing back at some point to more balance in the way coaches are hired. And I think, you know, if you look at teams that are at the top of the league right now, all right, teams that have made serious progress. I mean, let's take the Patriots and throw them out. Bill Belichick was hired 20 years ago, but he's a defensive coach. Okay. The Seahawks, Pete Carroll, they've been able to maintain success. They're having another good year. The Ravens, John Harbaugh, they've been able to maintain success. They're having another good year. The Buffalo Bills are 6-2. They've broken through a defensive head coach in Sean McDermott. The Minnesota Vikings have bounced back. They're 6-3. Mike Zimmer, defensive coach. And so I certainly think that what you're going to see this year is some teams analyzing it and saying to themselves, it's more important that we get a head coach than somebody who can coach one guy. And this is the way it should have always been. And I think part of the problem is people looked at guys like Sean McVay and only saw who he was as a quarterback's coach. Oh, well, he, you know, resurrected Jared Goff's career. He breathed life into who Goff was as a quarterback. You know, Kyle Shanahan, I think people look at him and say, well, you know, like, he really got the most out of Jimmy Garoppolo down the stretch in 2017. And they fail to realize that those guys have become very good head coaches beyond just what they can do in the offensive side of the ball, beyond what they can just do at the quarterback position. And so Robert Saleh is absolutely one name that I think will be in the mix for multiple head coaching vacancies. Dennis Allen from New Orleans is another one. Matt Eberflus, the defensive coordinator in Indianapolis, who interviewed very well in Cleveland last year, he would be a third. There are a ton of good young defensive coaches in the NFL who are waiting for their shot. And I think what we're going to find now is because there have been so many teams that have hired quarterback-centric guys, someone's going to look at this and say to themselves, it doesn't make sense for everybody to be fishing off the same pier. There's a ton of supply in this pond that nobody's been fishing in. So why would we be fishing in the pond that everybody has been casting their lines in? I just think it makes more sense to sort of broaden your search in these sorts of scenarios. And again, there's downside to it. If you know you want to develop a quarterback and you do a good job developing the quarterback, you know, you lose offensive coaches as a result of it if your, you know, offensive coordinator isn't your head coach. But I do think that there's a ton of proof out there that it's not that relevant, like that what side of the ball your head coach is coming from. And I think there are good candidates out there. Again, guys like Dennis Allen, guys like Matt Eberflus, guys like Robert Saleh, even somebody like Mike Pettine who could merit a second chance, guys like Wink Martindale. There are lots of good defensive coaches out there. Shelby, question number four.
Another voicemail.
Hey, Albert, Landon. So obviously the Colts have a pretty well-rounded team, not a lot of major holes throughout that roster. So just kind of wondering, in the future drafts next year and going forward, where do they try to build up? Do they keep trying to build up that defensive line, the secondary? I can see receivers as well. But what do you think is Jacoby? Is he truly the franchise quarterback going forward? I love the guy, but just looking for, is he going to be the one that takes them to the AFC title game or even to the Super Bowl? Thanks, Albert.
And thank you, Landon. That's a good question. I do think that they believe in Jacoby. I would just tell you that everybody I know who's been around Jacoby believes in him. What's his ceiling? I'm not sure. Can he be a top five quarterback? I don't know. But he's absolutely efficient. He's shown a capability of running the offense that Frank Reich wants to run. He's got good infrastructure around him. And so I really like where they're at with Jacoby Brissett as their quarterback. You know, they're, of course, hoping to get him back off of that sprained MCL this week. As for where they're where they'll look, I know that they came out of the offseason really feeling like there were two primary needs that they had as Chris Ballard's built this thing up. They still need sort of that war daddy pass rusher, and they still need a number one receiver. And I think probably after the way some of these things have played out, corner would probably be emerging as maybe something that would be a sneaky need that they might want to address. The way they play defense doesn't demand like top shelf corners, but I still think that that would be a position they would look at. So the three positions I would look at going into the next offseason, see if they can find a number one receiver or add depth to the position, see if they can find the big time pass rusher, and then find a way to build up some depth at corner, where I think the way it's played out with Quincy Wilson, who was their second-round pick a couple years ago, has hurt him. Shelby, question number five.
Another voicemail from Zach.
Hey, Albert, Zach. Had a question wondering if you thought, if you were surprised by the number of teams that passed on Josh Gordon. And then secondly, in terms of the waiver rules, could a team, let's say, like Miami, have selected him or claimed him off of waivers and then dealt him immediately to another team that may have wanted him just in exchange for a draft pick? So just curious about that. Love the show. Thanks.
Thanks, Zach. Appreciate the call. They couldn't trade him because we're past the trade deadline, but I don't believe there's anything that would prevent you from claiming a guy and then trading him a week or two later if it was September or October still. And so that would certainly be a possibility, and some – yeah, I could see an industrious GM sort of looking at it and saying, this would be a way for us to sort of create an asset out of nothing and then find a way to make something of that asset. As for why he wasn't claimed, I'd say the biggest thing there is this is the sort of player, because of his background, that you want to bring into your building before you sign him. You want to sit down and talk to him. You want to get to know him a little bit. You want to figure out where he's at. You want to figure out how healthy he is, all of that different stuff. And when a player hits the waiver wire, there's just simply not enough time to do that. And so I think part of the reason why I think it was 27 teams wound up passing on him was because it's just because there's so much there that you have to wade through from a background standpoint. It's impossible to do that in 24 hours. And by rule, you can't bring him in. You know, you can't like fly him in and sit him down and all that different stuff that you'd like to do. And so I think as tempting as it might have been for team X, Y, or Z, team X, Y, or Z is probably sitting there and saying, it's just not worth the hoops we're going to have to jump through at this point based on like the lack of background that we have in the player, if that makes sense. All right, Shelby, question number six.
Last one from David. Albert, as an NFL expert, how do you watch the games each week?
David, that's a good question. I'll explain it to you as best I can. I have television responsibilities every Sunday, so I do an hour and a half to 2 hours pregame, an hour and a half to 2 hours postgame on Patriots pre and post on NBC Sports in Boston. So I've got that I'm dealing with. I have the Sunday rundown that I do my Periscope on Sunday mornings. Basically, the way I track everything, I have my iPad with me. I have that on the Red Zone channel. So when I'm sitting at the desk in Foxborough, I've got the Red Zone channel going, and I'm taking notes on what's happening in the different games across the league. I also try to just sort of track where the news is going through social media. And, you know, and then obviously when I'm off camera, I'm able to kind of keep an eye on more than one game. It's hard. You try to figure out what the top storylines are. You try to pay attention to as much as you can, but I'm not going to lie. It's impossible to see everything. So you just try to ascertain what the top storylines are, figure out what you can figure out. And then my process is, after that, to start to make phone calls to get people to talk about what happened in the games for my Monday column. So that winds up being a process that takes me into my writing, which takes me to 5 a.m. usually, which is usually when I file the Monday morning quarterback. It's complicated. It's long. It's usually about a 20-hour day for me. But I get to cover football for a living. So I'm not digging ditches. I'm not, you know, going down in a coal mine. I'm not doing any of that. It's a blast. It's fast-paced. It's a little stressful. But to do the job the right way, I believe that's how you have to do it. Appreciate all you guys coming out. As always, we would welcome your feedback. Whatever we can do to make this podcast better for you, that's what we want to do. You can get to me on all my social media channels, on Twitter, at Albert Breer, on Facebook, at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram, at Albert _ Breer. And you can subscribe to all the MMQB podcasts in one feed. That's the Monday Morning Podcast, the Deep Dive Podcast, Connor and Jenny's podcast, this podcast, the Gambling Podcast. That's all on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. You should also subscribe to the MMQB news feed. That gives you a bite-sized news podcast, perfect for your ride home. It'll catch you up on everything that's going on in the NFL in about 5 minutes. Good way to just figure out what's going on across the league if you actually had to work while you're at work and you couldn't screw around on your computer or whatever. So both those podcasts, good take on both of them. The MMQB NFL podcast, the MMQB news podcast. You can get those two podcasts on the two separate feeds on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.